Good afternoon, everybody. In order to keep things going, it's about 3:30, so let's go ahead and get started. And I'd like to welcome you all to polycystic liver disease. One, if you're looking for the advanced PKD genetics, that's being held in Regency ENF, and the AR-PKD session is in Washington A. We also hope that you enjoyed the ice cream break. Today it was sponsored by Life Science. It's my privilege now to introduce our speaker for the polycystic liver disease seminar, Dr. Vicente Torres. Dr. Torres is a past chair of the PKD Foundation Scientific Advisory Committee. And in fact, Dr. Torres has just stepped down from the committee where he has been a member for the last 12 years, which actually marks him, I believe, as the longest standing member of the Scientific Advisory Committee. And so we are grateful for having Vince here today. He is a professor of medicine and chair of the Division of Nephrology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And so at this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Vicente Torres.
Thanks very much, Scott, and thanks to everyone for coming to the session and being interested on polycystic liver disease. What I would like to do over the next 45 minutes or so is to try to answer some questions for you, and hope this will be clear, but if you have some of this is not, just please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. What I would like to answer is first is to talk about what the liver is and how does it work, what is polycystic liver disease, how do the cysts develop, what are the manifestations or symptoms of polycystic liver disease, and answer the question, can polycystic liver disease be treated and how? So starting with the first question about what is the liver and what does it do, and that's a cartoon taken from Google, and that shows the liver in the position in the body. So the liver is one of the largest organs in the body. It weighs about 2 to 3 pounds, normal liver. It's in the right upper side of the abdomen, just behind the lower ribs, so it's protected by the ribs, and is covered by a muscle layer, which is called the diaphragm, that separates the liver from the lungs. So when we breathe, the liver goes up and down as the diaphragm goes up and down. It's closely connected to the stomach, and some of the manifestations you have with severe polycystic liver disease are related to this kind of proximity between the liver and the stomach. It's very important to understand what the liver does. And the liver, as the kidney, purifies the blood. It's a unique organ in the sense that has a dual blood flow. That's the only organ that receives blood through an artery. About 20% of the blood goes into the liver through the hepatic artery. And this arterial blood is oxygenated blood, so this artery is important because it brings to the liver the oxygen that is necessary for the liver to function and survive. But 80% of the blood that goes into the liver goes through this vein that's called the portal vein. And this vein brings blood from the stomach that has gone through the stomach and has gone through the gut first. So this vein doesn't bring oxygen to the liver. What it brings are nutrients. And the liver, the function of the liver is to store these nutrients and also to clean up this blood, to remove from this blood toxins and waste products. And either the liver breaks these products down or excretes them into the bile, into this bile duct, which are shown in green, and then the bile duct goes out and goes into the gut. So kind of, in a way, similar to the kidney. You have blood going in and waste products going out. Now, the blood that goes into the liver goes out through these veins that are called the hepatic veins that go to the inferior vena cava and to the heart. Very important to have this venous drainage because if the blood cannot go out, there is increased pressure in the liver, and that results in disease. So that's a very important concept for you to have. The liver gets dual blood supply arterial blood flow from the hepatic artery that provides oxygen to the liver, and the venous flow comes from the bowel and from the stomach that brings nutrients to the liver, and the liver kind of purifies this blood by removing the toxins and the waste products. Now, what is polycystic liver disease? Well, like polycystic kidney disease, polycystic liver disease is characterized by the development of cysts in the liver, and when these cysts are many, it results in enlargement of the liver, so the liver is enlarged. You have the multiple liver cysts here. That's a CT scan showing cross-section of the liver with the cysts. Now, polycystic liver disease comes with two flavors. One is autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, and the other one is autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease. In autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, you have the liver cysts, and the liver cysts are associated to polycystic kidneys. So you have cysts in the liver, and you have cysts in the kidneys. In this disease, many of the most dreadful manifestations are related to the kidneys, with hypertension and kidney failure. That in some patients, polycystic liver disease can be so severe that becomes the main manifestation. Now, the other type is autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease. And in this disease, you have a liver that looks exactly the same that it looks in autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. But if you look at the kidneys here and here, you see these kidneys have no cysts at all. They are perfectly normal kidneys. The only thing that they are not normal is because they are pushed around by the liver. You can see these kidneys being displaced in front of the spine by a liver that is pushing. But these kidneys are perfectly normal. So that's autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease that has no kidney involvement. And these are the genes that are responsible for the diseases. You are more familiar with the PKD1 and the PKD2 gene that cause autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease that can involve the liver as well. But then you have autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease. And in the last year, two genes causing autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease have been identified, and they are named PLD1 and PLD2. And the proteins encoded by these genes are named glucosidase 2 and SERC63. Now, the proteins that are encoded by the PKD1 and PKD2 genes are, one is a membrane receptor and the other one is a calcium channel, and these two proteins interact. And they are important because they regulate intracellular calcium. And I'll go that into a moment, but just very superficially. Now, these proteins that are mutated in the polycystic liver disease that does not involve the kidney, these proteins are not found in the plasma membrane, or the cilia that probably you have already heard about. They are found in a part of the cell that's called endoplasmic reticulum, where the proteins are modified and folded properly and mature properly. Now, this is kind of the cartoon from a paper from the Igarashi's group showing what the function of the polycystins is. And as you can see here, it says urine flow, but that's the wrong talk for this. So we'll change that to bile flow. And what you can see is that in these polycystins, in these cilia, what they do is they sense flow, and they are able to, in response to this flow, to open up the channel, which is the polycystin 2, and allow calcium to go into the cell. And that seems to be probably the most important function of the polycystins. Now, the proteins mutated in autosomal dominant polycystic liver disease are found not on the surface of the cell or in the cilia. They are found in the endoplasmic reticulum, and the endoplasmic reticulum is contains a factory where the proteins, as they are formed, they are modified in a number of ways. And two of the genes, or two of the proteins that are mutated in polycystic liver disease are these ones, SEC63 and glucosidase 2. And probably these proteins are important for the proper maturation of polycystins and are particularly important in the liver, and that's why you have the disease only in the liver. Now, that's kind of a very dry, kind of scientific type of thing, but the reason I'm mentioning that is because I think it's very likely that as we understand more how that works, that this will maybe result in the future in understanding better how both polycystic kidney disease and polycystic liver disease develop and maybe open some possibilities for treatment. Now, how do the liver cysts develop? Now, the way they develop is a way which is very similar to the way they develop in the kidney. Now, this represents the normal biliary tract or the normal bile ducts. Here is the gallbladder, and these are the different bile ducts, and which are surrounded by the liver. And as you go more and more peripherally, these bile ducts get thinner and thinner. The liver cysts develop in two areas. One is they develop from the most peripheral, the smallest of these bile ducts, which are called intralobular ductules, and they develop also from proliferation of glands which are around the larger bile ducts, which are called peribiliary glands. So from this area and this area, these cells proliferate, and they form dilatation. Now, this is a polycystic kidney, a tubule that has been microdissected from a polycystic kidney, and you can see a very thin tubule and these little balloons, which are magnified here. And as they grow, they become disconnected from the tubule, so they become like blind sacs. The same thing happens in the liver. As these dilatations grow, they become disconnected from the bile ducts, and they become bile sacs. And then the way these cysts grow is by fluid secretion into this cyst. And this fluid secretion also occurs by a process which is very similar to the process that occurs in the kidney, which is driven by chloride secretion through this channel, which is called CFTR. The same thing happens in the kidney. And is driven by this messenger in the cell, which is called cyclic AMP. The only thing is different is that the hormones that are capable to stimulate the cyclic AMP in these biliary epithelial cells are different from those that stimulate the fluid secretion in the tubular epithelial cells in the kidney. But the process seems to be very similar, which means that probably the therapeutic approaches or the treatment approaches will need to be quite similar as well. Now, developing cysts in the liver is part of normal aging. If we live long enough, everyone develops liver cysts, but we have to live long enough, and most of us don't. So, but you can see the frequency of the liver cysts. They are very rare in the first 30 or 40 years of life, and then when you get to be 60 and 80, then the number of individuals that have liver cysts goes up. But usually it's only a small number, rarely more than 3. In polycystic liver disease, this process is greatly magnified. And you can see that after the age of 20, you start developing cysts, and eventually about 70 to 80% of the patients develop cysts in the liver, and the number of cysts is much more numerous than in the general population. Now, interestingly, these liver cysts develop earlier and are more numerous in women, shown in orange, than in men, shown in green. And they are more frequent in women that have had pregnancies than those that have not had pregnancies. And this indicates that in some way the female hormones, estrogens, help these cysts to develop. Importantly, after menopause, the women that take hormonal replacement therapy with estrogens, the cysts, the size of the liver, and the cysts continue to increase, whereas those that do not take hormonal replacement, the cysts do not increase. So in patients who have severe polycystic liver disease, it's important to stay away from hormonal replacement therapy. Now, what are the symptoms that develop as a consequence of polycystic liver disease? Well, the good news is that the majority of patients have no symptoms with polycystic liver disease. But those that develop symptoms is due to one of these three situations. One is large cysts, a small number of very dominant large huge cysts, like this one. That's clearly a cyst large enough by itself to produce symptoms, or can be due to relatively large medium-sized cysts like these ones, or can be due to a large amount of a small cysts that is not, you cannot find a single large cyst here, but you can see a lot of a small cysts causing massive enlargement of the liver. So it's one of these three situations. And the effects of this the symptoms are mostly related to mass effect. As you can see, this patient, this is just liver, and you can realize that this patient has abdominal fullness and abdominal distension and this feeling of a sensation of fullness. In addition to that, there is compression of the stomach. I'll show you some CT scans later. And this results in early satiety. That means that patients, when they eat, they may feel hungry, but they eat, and shortly after eating a little bit, they're already full because the stomach doesn't have more room. And also because of the pressure on the stomach, there is a reflux of acid from the stomach into the esophagus, which gives problems with heartburn. And rarely, the problem can be severe enough that this patient may have emesis or vomiting, but that's not very common. Now, if this is severe, it can lead to malnutrition. And as a result of malnutrition, patients with severe polycystic liver disease lose subcutaneous fat and muscle, so they become somewhat weakened by the disease. Because of the pressure of the liver over on the diaphragm, it is more difficult to breathe, and this results in shortness of breath or dyspnea, particularly laying down on their back when they are in bed. That's what orthopnea means. Because they carry this weight in front of them all the time, it's like walking around with a sack of potatoes in front, and that results in strain on the back and mechanical low back pain. In the more severe cases, you can have herniations. Actually, hernias, abdominal hernias, are quite common in patients with severe polycystic liver disease, and it can result in some cases in uterine prolapse, even rib fractures. And so these are all effects or symptoms, manifestations related to the enlargement of the liver per se. Now, the liver, as it enlarges, can cause obstruction of veins, mostly the hepatic veins, but more rarely the inferior vena cava and the portal vein that goes into the liver. And also, and that's quite rare, can cause obstruction of the bile ducts. So all these symptoms are related just to the mass effect of the liver. Now, there are some other manifestations that can be related to complications of polycystic liver disease. And one that is not very common but can occur is hemorrhage into a cyst. The cysts in the liver do not hemorrhage as often as the cysts in the kidney, but they can do that. And the manifestation that you can have with when you have bleeding into a cyst in the liver is abdominal pain, mostly in the right upper quadrant, and quite frequently fever. And because of this manifestation of abdominal pain and fever, frequently these episodes may be misdiagnosed as an episode of cholecystitis, which is an infection in the gallbladder. Now, rupture of a cyst into the abdomen can occur, but is usually related to trauma and is very rare. It does not happen. It happens very rarely. Very few cases reported in the literature, but the presentation is quite dramatic, kind of an acute abdomen that can present like if something very serious has happened. This patient may end up having surgery most of the times unnecessarily, but that's a very rare complication. Now, the other complication that is not that rare, it's not common, but is not that rare, is infection of a liver cyst. And infection of the liver cyst also can present with recurrent fevers and shaking chills. And these infections need to be treated with antibiotics for a long time and frequently require percutaneous drainage of the cyst to get rid of infection. Now, there are other manifestations of polycystic liver disease that are very rare, and I will skip these ones because they are in autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease are quite rare. Now, the one good thing about polycystic liver disease is that liver function remains normal. Now, despite severe polycystic liver disease, liver function is usually not a problem. So you can have massively enlarged livers and still they function well. And this is due to that to the fact that frequently part of the liver is spared or relatively spared. So that's a polycystic liver. As you can see, part of the liver is massively cystic, but the other part is relatively spared. It's not has cysts in it, but looks much better. And also, the normal amount of tissue, of liver tissue, despite the massive enlargement of the liver with the cyst, if you quantify the normal amount of liver tissue, this amount of liver tissue remains normal. And this is due to the fact that the liver has a great capacity to regenerate itself. It's not like the kidneys, the liver can regenerate itself very well. So that explains why the liver function remains normal. Now there is one exception to this rule that the liver function remains normal, and is there in some patients in which the outflow of the blood out of the liver by through the hepatic veins can be compromised because of the veins being squeezed by the cyst. And this we call hepatic venous outflow obstruction. When you have that, you have increased pressure in the veins inside the liver, and that long term, after years, can result in damage of the liver tissue and impair the liver function. And the manifestation, the most typical manifestation of this presentation is accumulation of fluid in the abdomen. So there can be some leakage of fluid from the surface of the liver that accumulates on the abdomen, and this accumulation of fluid in the abdomen is called ascites. And you can see that the inferior vena cava returns the blood from the lower part of the body to the heart, and as it goes through the liver and where the hepatic veins go into the inferior vena cava, that is markedly compressed by the cyst, and that's what's causing this hepatic venous outflow obstruction. Now, this complication can occur spontaneously in some patients, but it frequently can occur as a result of surgery, any kind of abdominal surgery, and particularly it has been described following bilateral nephrectomies in patients that have huge polycystic livers and have large kidneys as well, and the kidneys are taken out. The reason why this has happened is not known, but the one of the hypotheses is as we take the kidneys out, there is some shifting of the liver, and that's enough maybe to kink the veins even further to the point that compromises further an already compromised outflow of blood out of the liver. So that's the possible mechanism of that. Now, this complication, thankfully, is not very, very common, but it can happen. Now, when it happens, then you have portal hypertension. That's not a polycystic liver, that's a cirrhotic liver, but it shows kind of the same thing. What happens is the blood doesn't go out of the liver properly. There is increased pressure of the blood in the portal veins, and then this blood that has to go back to the heart through alternative pathways, and one of them is the veins that line the stomach and the esophagus, and this results in the development of esophageal varices that can bleed, and this is very rare complication of polycystic liver disease. It's much more common complication of cirrhosis, but it can occasionally happen in polycystic liver disease. Now, the complication that is not as rare is having low platelets, which is when you have modest amounts of increased pressure in this portal vein. The spleen that is drained by a vein that goes into the porta, it becomes larger, and the spleen, it kind of consumes platelets, so you can have low platelets in the circulation. And patients with polycystic liver disease, quite frequently they have a slight reduction in the platelet count in the blood, which is of no significance. So the final question is, can polycystic liver disease be treated and how? And again, the answer here is that most patients with polycystic liver disease do not require any treatment. So that's, and even patients know the estrogens are not contraindicated in all patients with polycystic kidney disease. They are only contraindicated in patients with polycystic kidney disease that have significant polycystic liver disease. Now, for those who are more unfortunate that they have significant polycystic liver disease, if something needs to be done, there are three types of interventions that can be considered. One is non-surgical options, the other one is surgical options, and the other one is rarely indicated options. Now, the non-surgical options are somewhat limited and consist of first avoiding estrogens, birth control pills, hormonal replacement therapy, and avoiding caffeine, because the caffeine results in further accumulation of cyclic AMP and probably is not good for patients with either severe polycystic kidney disease or severe polycystic liver disease, at least in large amounts. In small amounts, probably is okay. Now, the other thing is that can give symptomatic relief, because one of the major symptoms that patients with severe polycystic liver disease have is symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux with heartburn. And treatment with H2 blockers or pump inhibitors, which are given to treat gastroesophageal reflux, give symptomatic relief. But in addition to that, they may be beneficial. There is one study that suggests that may be beneficial because as you lower the acid in the stomach, you inhibit the production of a hormone that is produced in the gut, which is called secretin, that is the main hormone that seems to drive the fluid secretion in the liver cysts. So there may be some added benefit, although has not been proven scientifically, of using H2 blockers or pump-2 inhibitors in patients with severe polycystic liver disease. Now, there are other approaches that there is no proof that they can be effective. Actually, the small experience shows that they are not very effective. One is some hormonal treatment to cut down the production of estrogen with leuprolide, and the other one is a drug called somatostatin. However, the publications that have shown that these are ineffective are publications that were done in patients with very severe polycystic liver disease that were not candidates for anything else, so probably were used in the most desperate cases, and it's based on a very small number of patients. So I don't think neither one of these two medical treatments has been given a fair chance or has been adequately tested. But at the present time, based on what is available, I don't think one can recommend either one of these two things. Now, in terms of the surgical interventions for severe polycystic liver disease, you have four options. One is percutaneous aspiration and sclerosis of the cysts. Percutaneous aspiration with the needle alone doesn't do much because the fluid comes back after a few weeks. So if you want to do this, you have to do the aspiration of the fluid out of the cyst and then inject something into the cyst that kills the lining cells so the fluid doesn't come back. And that's called percutaneous aspiration and sclerosis. The next one is just fenestration of the cyst, which means unroofing the cyst, opening up the cyst. And this can be done either with open surgery or with laparoscopic surgery. The next treatment is hepatic resection combined with fenestration, so taking part of the liver out, doing a resection of the liver. And the last one is liver transplantation. And the liver transplantation can be from cadavers or can be from living donors. Living donors for polycystic liver disease have been done only in a handful of cases, but they have been done. So now these are the surgical options. Now, these surgical options are not to be considered in all the patients that need something done. The options to be selected depend on how the cysts look like. Patients like this, for example, with a large dominant liver cyst that causes symptoms, this patient is ideally treated by alcohol sclerosis. So this patient does not require surgery. What it requires is draining the cyst and sclerosing the cyst with alcohol. And it may need to be done several times to be successful. But this patient does not require alcohol sclerosis. Patient like that could be approached either surgically or could be approached with alcohol sclerosis with multiple sessions or even with laparoscopic surgery. A patient like this, to go with alcohol sclerosis or laparoscopic surgery is a complete waste of time, because there is nothing could be achieved. So the way the liver looks is dictates what type of treatment is indicated, if any. Now, these are older slides, so these actually are 10-year older slides, but nothing much has changed, so I'm showing this. This is an early experience that we had with alcohol sclerosis on 13 patients, and that shows a cyst that was causing symptoms, a catheter that is inserted into the cyst, the fluid is drained, contrast is ingested into the cyst to be sure the cyst does not communicate with the bile ducts, because if it communicates with the bile ducts, you cannot inject anything into the cyst because it would be extremely dangerous. And then the patient, after you know for sure it does not communicate with the bile ducts, you take the contrast out, you inject the alcohol in, and then the patient has to lay in the four different positions so the alcohol is in touch, in contact with the whole surface of the cyst, and then after 1 hour or so, you take the alcohol out. And now with this type of intervention, in about 70% of the cases, you can resolve the cyst. The cyst becomes much smaller or disappears. And in an additional 23% of the cases, you need to have this done a second time to be successful. But you can be reasonably successful with this procedure when you are dealing with a small number of live cysts. The complications, there are no major complications with this procedure, but there are minor complications. Minor complications can be pain, fever related to the inflammation that you are inducing into the liver cyst. Now, this other procedure can be used also when you have a small number of large cysts and when they are approachable by laparoscopic surgery, not depending on where they are situated, they cannot be approached. And the laparoscopic surgery, as you know, you do the surgery without an open incision, just through some big trochers that are inserted in the abdominal wall, and you work through these small trochers, or the surgeon does work through these trochers. And now this procedure, can work for this type of situation. It does have some complications. In about almost half of the patients, they can develop transient ascites after the procedure, and this is due to the fact that when the cysts are unroofed, they continue to secrete fluid, and this fluid doesn't get contained to the cyst, so it goes into the cavity of the abdomen. So you can have ascites for a while after you do that, but eventually resolves. But the main problem with this procedure is that, except for the situation where you have few large cysts like that, the disease tends to recur in a high percentage of cases. So in a patient that has a lot of medium and small size cysts, it's not a very effective procedure. Now, this type of patient with a severe polycystic liver that is caused by large, very large amounts of a small cysts like this, alcohol sclerosis, laparoscopic surgery is a waste of time. If you need something done for this patient, you can do two things. One is resection of the liver, or the other thing is a liver transplant. Now, the resection of the liver, the criteria of when to do a resection as opposed to a liver transplant, you need to have preserved liver function, which is not a problem most of these patients have. Second one, you need to have relative preservation of part of the liver, two segments. The liver has 8 segments, so one requirement is to have at least 2 segments that are relatively spared. And the second thing is to have a good a performance score, a performance status of the patient, which is not too good and not too bad. You don't want to do this type of surgery in patients that they don't need it just because the liver looks bad. You want to do this surgery in patients who have highly symptomatic because of a polycystic liver disease, but you don't want to wait until the patient is so debilitated that the risk of a surgery becomes very high. So that's kind of a decision has to be made of when is the right time to do that. Now, these are just examples of how these patients look like, and again, this surgery can be done because part of the liver is spared and because there is a good amount of liver parenchyma and the liver has great capacity to regenerate. And these are examples of patients with a surgery. As you can see, this part of the liver is very cystic, but this part is relatively spared. This part of the liver is very cystic. This part is relatively spared. The same here compared to here and here compared to here. That's kind of the segments, the anatomy of the liver with the different segments. And this is when we published the early experience about 8 or 9 years ago. We had about 31 patients, and this is the segment that were resected. So you can see this changes a lot from patient to patient. Some patients have most of the disease on the right side, some patients have it most on the left side. And this is kind of a different stage of the surgery, a massive polycystic liver. When the kind of an admit operation during the resection of the liver, that's the part of the liver that goes out, and that's what's left behind. And that's the part of the liver that comes out, which is basically just cystic tissue. These are the results of the early experience. The total kidney volume goes down from an average of 9 kilograms to about an average of 3.5. Mind you that this is still larger than a normal liver. And the thing to remember is that this surgery is not free of risk. You have mortality, which is about 3 to 5%, and you have complications that in about half of the patient develop some type of complication, which may be prolonged leakage of fluid, transient ascites, accumulation of fluid in the abdomen, and so on. So it's not a surgery that you go into easily. It's a surgery that you do whenever you have to do it, because otherwise the patient is going downhill. Now, this is an example of this natural history of polycystic liver disease before and after the surgery. This CT scan was obtained 10 years before the surgery. As you can see, part of the liver is preserved, part is cystic. That was 3 years after the surgery. The disease has progressed. The cystic part has become larger, and the good part has become squeezed here. That's immediately before the surgery. This is 1 year after the surgery. As you can see, the liver tissue that was squeezed has regenerated, has become hypertrophic, and the liver and the cysts have not developed fast. And this is 3 years after the surgery. On this particular patient, we have now about 7 years after the surgery, still doing quite well. Now, that's the ideal case you want to do surgery on. If you see this patient, it's no question that that's the right treatment to do. It's a very nice cutoff between the good liver tissue and the bad liver tissue. That's the ideal patient for this type of surgery. Now, this patient also had surgery. As you can see, there is a good part of the relatively good part of the liver here, relatively good part of the liver here. You cannot conserve both. You have to decide to sacrifice one. But despite that, that's kind of immediately after the surgery. You can see that there is plenty of good liver tissue left behind. So even in patients that look like that, you can do this surgery. Now, there are some patients in which obviously you cannot do this surgery because there is no spare part. Or the other reason sometimes you cannot do this surgery is because when you do the surgery, you have to be sure at the end of the surgery, the drainage of the liver, the veins that drain the liver are intact. And sometimes the cystic disease is surrounding these veins, and there is no way to take out that part of the liver without sacrificing the veins. And in this case, this type of liver surgery is not possible. Now, what about transplantation? Well, the experience with transplantation with polycystic liver disease, 10 patients at Mayo have been transplanted with polycystic liver disease. In the literature, the last time I prepared this slide, there were 76 that have been reported. There are more now. But the mortality at 1 year is about 20% in both cases. Of the 10 patients that were transplanted at Mayo, two died. One died months after the surgery because of complications from a viral infection. The other patient died shortly after the surgery. But I have to say that this patient that died shortly after the surgery is a patient that had had a liver resection years before and had a lot of adhesions, and that makes the transplant a little bit more difficult. So something that you have to take into account when you decide what to do with these patients is that if a liver resection is feasible, I think it's perfectly justified to go with a liver resection. But if there is some question about that, you have to realize that there may be some compromise and you may make the liver transplant later on somewhat more difficult. Not impossible to do, but somewhat more difficult. Again, maybe in terms of liver transplantation, I would like to kind of mention that all of these liver transplants here are from cadavers, but there have been some recent papers in which they have done living donor transplantation, where you transplant half of the liver from a living donor. And that's feasible. The mortality for the donor, however, is not as the mortality for a kidney donor, which is almost close to zero. The mortality for a liver donor is about 0.3%. So there is a 3 in 1,000 chance that the donor will die as a result of that. Not all the massive polycystic liver patients would be candidates for living donor transplantation. I have discussed that with our liver transplant surgeon at Mayo, and based on the anatomy of the CABA, he feels that probably about 75% of patients with massive polycystic liver disease it would be feasible to do a living donor transplant. Now, that's a type of treatment that has not been practiced a lot, but that's a possible therapy that can be done. Now, there are other types of treatment that are rarely indicated, but it's good to remember because in some cases may be used. One is to use endovascular stents. These are some devices to open up the vessels. And you can place these endovascular stents to open up vessels that are blocked by the cyst, either the inferior vena cava or the hepatic vein. I'll show you that. Another procedure is called transjugular intrahepatic portosystemic shunt, or TIPS. The other one is Levine shunt, and the last one is hepatic artery embolization. Now, the endovascular stent, this case, for example, the liver was causing a complete occlusion of the inferior vena cava. And you can see the blood doesn't go through the inferior vena cava. With time, it had developed collateral circulation, collateral veins. And this patient had severe edema of the lower extremities because of that. So that's the stent was placed, and after placing the stent, you can see normal return of the blood through the inferior vena cava. So that's one possible application of this treatment. You can do the same thing in the hepatic veins to open up hepatic veins. These stents usually have good results, so they do not plug, they do not clot, they remain open because these veins have high flow. Another type of treatment, which is this transjugular intrahepatic portosystemic shunt, and what this consists of is through the jugular vein in the neck. A catheter is advanced into the hepatic veins, it goes through the wall of the hepatic veins, through the liver, and into the porta, creating a shunt that then this expandable stent is placed. And this can be done relatively safely because the tissue, the hepatic tissue, prevents bleeding. Now, in polycystic liver, you have the liver cyst in between, so there may be there is the concern that if you have the blood going to the cyst, you can have severe bleeding into a cyst. Despite that, this has been done, and there are a number of reports in the literature of this having been done in polycystic liver patients. So this is feasible. Now, the important thing is you need to have, to do that, you need to have a hepatic vein that the flow out of the hepatic vein is not blocked by anything. If you have blockage here, connecting this to this, it wouldn't help. So that might help in a special situation. You have good drainage of at least one hepatic vein into the inferior vena cava and into the heart. So that's a possible treatment. Has been done rarely, but it has been done. And there may be individual patients in which it may be helpful. The other type of treatment is called Levine shunt. These are patients that have ascites because of portal hypertension, accumulation of fluid in the belly, and there is no way, either surgically or using a stent, that this pressure can be relieved. What can be done in this case is, because the liver function continues to be good, what can be done into this patient is to put a catheter that connects the abdominal cavity with the jugular vein. That catheter goes under the skin and has a valve, so the fluid can only circulate in one direction. And it's called a peritoneal venous shunt or Levine shunt. And this can be helpful in some patients. And then the final procedure is embolization of the hepatic arteries. And this has been done by an investigator or a clinician in Japan, Dr. Ubara, and has done in end-stage kidneys, and now he has started doing that in polycystic livers. Now, the rationale here is what they do, there are three hepatic arteries, the right, middle, and left, and sometimes what you have is a liver in which most of the liver tissue is supplied, of the good liver tissue, supplied by one of the arteries, and the other two are just supplying liver cystic tissue. And so what you can do is selectively embolize the arteries that are supplying the cystic tissue. When you do that, you deprive this tissue from oxygen, and as a result of that, this tissue becomes slowly dead and atrophies. When you do that, two things happen. One, patient develops pain for 2 or 3 days or 4 days, and then you have fever. But that's the side effects of doing that, according to this Japanese investigator. So this shows the hepatic arteries before the procedure, and this shows the hepatic arteries after the coils have been injected into the hepatic arteries to cause the embolization of these arteries. And that shows the results before and after the tissue, 2 years after, the tissue was measured by volumetric analysis, and there was although the tissue doesn't look, the liver still doesn't look too good, there is a 40% reduction in the size of the liver and kind of a benefit in terms of the symptoms of the patients. So that's a possible treatment that can be done in patients who are not candidates for anything else. And maybe as one gains experience with this procedure, maybe it will turn out that this procedure may be more helpful than we think. So maybe we have never done that at our center. We have a patient in which we are ready to go if he is willing to have it. But when we tell them that we have never done it, you know, patients are not very anxious to be the first ones. So now, what is hope for the future? Well, the hope for the future is that we'll know more about how this works, how the fluid secretion works. And, for example, if it was possible to block this hormone, secretin, that is what triggers the production of cyclic AMP and fluid secretion in the liver, it's possible that maybe with a drug or a medication, one can slow down the growth of disease or maybe even reverse the growth of disease. And in that case, one would add this medication to the margarita, and that would work just perfect. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to answer questions. When you have an infection of a liver cyst, the symptoms are mostly fever, with shaking chills quite often, sometimes pain, but the pain doesn't need to be there. The fever, shaking chills are the most common. It's very common when you have an infection in the liver cyst, at the same time you have infection in the bloodstream, so you have a septicemia or bacteremia, and you can... White blood cell count goes up, so yes, there's universally the white blood cell count is up. Alkaline phosphatase is usually elevated in the majority of patients. That's a liver enzyme. So, and the sedimentation rate is very high. There is a shift to the left in the type of leukocytes, so there are more segmented leukocytes than and more immature form of leukocytes. So there is, as compared to lymphocytes, white blood cells. So yeah, there is all these changes occur, but this is not specific. But the clinical picture is very suggestive. The question is, how do you localize what liver cyst is infected? Because you have many liver cysts. And then there's a number of tests that one can be done. One is a white blood cell scan. You label white blood cells, you take white blood out of the patient, take the white blood, separate the white blood cells, label the white blood cells with an isotope called indium 111, and inject the white blood cells back, and then these white blood cells go to the site of infection, and then you can see that with a nuclear scan that they are accumulated there. Now, this type of test is helpful. It sometimes can be negative if you do it very early, sometimes can be negative if you do it very late, but most of the times it's positive. CT scan and MRI are helpful, but they do not differentiate usually infected cysts from other complicated cysts. So they can just tell you, they show you this cyst is different than the others, but it doesn't tell you whether it's infected or hemorrhagic, unless there is gas inside, which is very rare. There is a recent paper in which they have used PET scanning to diagnose liver cysts, and the utility of PET scanning to diagnose infected liver cysts, it remains open. It's just a recent publication that has suggested that. In most cases, what you like to do is once you have a cyst that has been localized by imaging studies that is likely to be infected, you want to puncture the cyst, take some fluid out for culture, and to be sure that you know what cyst is infected and to know what kind of bacteria is growing, because that's very helpful to determine the antibiotic you want to use. And liver cysts, many times, it's you have to end up putting a catheter into the liver cyst to have it drain continuously for a few days to completely eliminate infection. Otherwise, they tend to come back. And even if you treat the liver cyst for 6 weeks or 2 months, they have a high rate of recurrence, even with prolonged antibiotics. Yep. Well, that's a problem. That's because what happened with the patient that have severe polycystic liver disease, and that is concluded that a liver resection would be too risky, or that in their case is not possible, and they are referred for liver transplant. The problem is that they are accepted in the list, but they are not given a very high priority, because the liver function is normal and they compete with other patients who are dying because of liver failure. So that's a real problem. And so that's one of the things that with a living donor could be solved, but a living donor is not the same as giving a kidney. It's much more involved and it's a real risk to the donor. Yep. No. Well, usually when you have a patient that is going to have severe polycystic liver disease, most patients that present with severe polycystic liver disease, they present in their early 40s. Sometimes some patients early, like early 30s, but most patients with the early 40s, they present with the same history. They say, well, all of a sudden my liver start growing and become massive. In reality, what happens is that has been increasing over time, but it just gets to a point, a threshold, where the patient becomes aware of it and then focuses on that, and then it seems that it has been developing very fast, when in fact it has been developing slowly over time. But if you do, if you have a patient with polycystic liver disease in their late 20s or early 30s, and if you have a good imaging study of the liver, like a CT scan, you know whether this patient is going to have severe polycystic liver disease or not. If a patient like that has a few tiny cysts, you know this patient will never have severe polycystic liver disease. But if you have a patient that already has lots of cysts in the liver at this age, you know that this patient has potential for having severe polycystic liver disease in the future, in the next 10, 20 years. In these patients that have this potential for severe polycystic liver disease are the ones that you want to advise against birth control pills, and the ones that also you want to advise to consider very seriously whether to have pregnancies or not, because the size of the liver increases with the pregnancy, and that we have seen patients that which we have CT scan before and after pregnancy, and you can see a change related to the pregnancy. So. But you can never tell a patient not to get pregnant, but you can tell the patient to consider seriously the pros and cons and then decide on her own what to do. Yeah. Well, referred pain is common. You can have, well, it's not common, but it can occur in polycystic liver patients. Pain referred to the shoulder. This happens when you have anything going wrong in cysts that are on the top of the liver, on the real surface of the liver, just under the diaphragm. You have bleeding into a cyst like that, or you have an infection into a cyst like that. And also I remember one case that saw some years ago that's very rare, which is kind of a malignant cholangiocarcinoma developing in the cyst there. In patients that have any kind of something going wrong in cysts which are on the surface of the liver, irritate the diaphragm, and it's the irritation of the diaphragm that gives you the pain on the shoulder. So it's not the liver itself, it's the diaphragm. So the referred pain in the shoulder means that you have something going wrong in the top of the liver, under the diaphragm. Well, it not necessarily the cyst, but usually in the patient with polycystic liver is because they have bled into a cyst. That's the most common thing. You have a cyst on the surface of the liver, just under the diaphragm, and you bleed there. That gives you referred pain to the shoulder. Yeah. No, that was this patient was just pure liver.
So how large can it get?
It can get very large, like 20 kilos, 40 pounds. Yep. I think a patient that has significant or severe polycystic liver disease, I would say that probably is better not to take either one, neither the patch nor the pill. Now, a patient that has kind of intermediate, the patch theoretically, this has not been proven, but theoretically is better because it's absorbed through the skin. So medications that are absorbed through the bowel, they go into the portal vein, and all the amount of the medication, the first organ that sees this medication is the liver. So the whole amount of medication goes into the liver. When you absorb it through the skin, it gets distributed into the whole body. So not as much of it goes to the liver. So theoretically, if you want to minimize the estrogen exposure to the liver, you use the patch. But if you have someone with severe polycystic liver disease, probably it's better to stay away from both. Soy products? Soy products, I don't know. Mrs. Smith here knows. But soy products have phytoestrogens. Now, whether phytoestrogens can do something bad to the liver or no, there is absolutely no information. It's possible, but there is no information. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how much would be absorbed. Yeah, I usually tell if severe polycystic liver disease, I even advise against using estrogen creams, vaginal estrogen creams, yeah. Yeah. Well, in terms of the size of the cyst, depends. There are some patients that may have some pain, very localized pain, that very nicely correlates on the CT scan, maybe with a cyst that is not particularly big, but maybe quite superficial, and maybe more irritating, maybe a 5-centimeter cyst or something like that. If you have this correlation, it would seem reasonable to go ahead and sclerose this cyst. But most cysts that give symptoms are usually much larger than that, like 10, 12, 14 centimeters in diameter. In terms of the rationale for the pump inhibitors or the H2 blockers, is that pump inhibitor H2 blockers lower, the way they work is by preventing the secretion of acid into the stomach. Now, in normal individuals, in everybody, the secretion of acid into the stomach stimulates the production of a hormone that's called secretin that is released from the gut into the bloodstream. And this hormone goes to everywhere in the body, including the liver. And this hormone stimulates the secretion of fluid by the cyst. Was a study done by a gastroenterologist in Colorado, Greg Iverson, that he placed catheters into cysts in the liver, and then he injected secretin into the vein, and when he did that, the amount of fluid secreted by the liver cysts went up markedly. So In theory, if you could block secretin from being produced or from the action, then it would be beneficial. Now, the H2 blockers and proton pump inhibitors, in theory, they should be able to lower the production of secretin by cutting down the acid in the stomach. So that's the mechanism. It's all very theoretical. There was a study published many years ago in France in which they did liver resections, and after liver resection they had some patients that have increased fluid secretion, which is a common complication of the liver resection for some time, and they used H2 blockers, and they claimed that with the H2 blockers the rate of secretion of the fluid, or the rate of the drainage, went down, and on that basis that would be what it gets closer, but it was certainly not a randomized study or a controlled study in any way. So this is a potential possible benefit, far from being proven. But certainly you can take the medication if you have heartburn, and you may be added bonus to taking the medication. Well, there is some research being done right now. Actually, Dr. Masuk is sitting there, is working with Dr. LaRusso at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. LaRusso is a liver specialist whose area of expertise is the biology of the cholangiocyte, the cells that line this cyst and make the bile ducts. And they are interested in studying these, and they have a number of approaches that they are following to work on that. Ideally, great news would be if someone would develop some type of blocker that was capable to block the action of secretin on the liver. That is something that would be great research to do, but that's something that probably would have to be done by a pharmaceutical company that has capacity to test, to do high throughput testing of a lot of compounds to find one that does that. Well, there are some other approaches that one can use. Like, for example, somatostatin could work. In theory, it should lower the cycle KMP. That's one possible way that is being investigated. There are some other indirect ways to do that. So, yeah, there is research being done. But, yeah. I'm sure there are other centers that do the same research, but you know, I can't talk to you about the one I know. Yeah. Yeah. My question is someone who knows about it. Well, it depends. It can be a nephrologist, it can be a hepatologist. It's just having expertise with that disease. There are hepatologists that. No, polycystic liver disease has been ignored by liver specialists until recently because they have been more interested in other diseases. But I think the important thing is to have a physician who has expertise in the area. I think probably a hepatologist will be best suited to do that if it's someone who really has expertise in this area. But there are many hepatologists that don't. So, yep. Well, in polycystic liver disease depends, and the frequency of liver cysts depends on how well you look. Now, in the CRISPR study, which I'm thinking you are familiar with, part of the study, they looked at the liver. With MRI, now it turns out that 90% of the patients in the CRISPR study have liver cysts. But the MRI is capable to detect very tiny liver cysts. So if you really, probably you take the liver and when you cut the liver, you see a cyst in everyone. So it depends on how sensitive your study is. But in terms of the spleen, the association of a spleen cyst with polycystic polycystic kidney disease is questionable. There are other diseases that look like cysts in the spleen, that one called lymphangiomatosis. They have lymphatic cysts in the spleen and the liver. The other thing, sometimes the liver extends into the left side, and sometimes liver cysts are confused with spleen cysts. So cysts in the spleen are very rare, and whether they are more common in polycystic kidney disease than anywhere else, I don't know. I have my doubts about the spleen cysts. Now, pancreas, there is no question about that. There are good studies done, and the frequency of pancreas cysts is 8%. And the other part where you have relatively frequent cysts is the arachnoid membranes that cover the brain, and the frequency of arachnoid cysts is also 8%. Now, the pancreas cysts and arachnoid cysts, you can forget about them because they don't cause problems, except in very, very rare situations. I suppose it possibly could, but I think it's not likely. No, unless the laparoscopic fenestration is complicated or causes a big shift in the position of the liver or something like that. I think it would be very unlikely. So I think the fluid accumulation that occurs in the abdomen after laparoscopic fenestration is not due to hepatic venous outflow obstruction. It's just due to the cyst continue to secrete fluid, and after several weeks, it just goes away.
What causes the cyst to hurt?
Yes.
How to avoid it?
Well, I think the most likely the fullness is just related to the size, and sometimes where fullness stops and hurt begins is kind of a not a very clear differentiation. If it's clear pain, I think it's mostly related to irritation of the capsule of the liver where the nerve endings are. So these are cysts which are kind of superficial, not deep inside the tissue, but superficial, kind of irritating the capsule of the liver, and that frequently some cysts that have been complicated by bleeding and there is inflammation around it, and maybe some inflammatory reaction every time you breathe, the liver goes up and down and can cause some pain. It's pretty soon. I'm not probably because we haven't had ourselves experience with laparoscopic fenestration, we have done very few cases, and usually only patients that had one or two cysts. To me, laparoscopic fenestration, I'm not very enthusiastic about it because I think the patients that you can treat satisfactorily with laparoscopic fenestration, probably you can deal with them with alcohol sclerosis. So, and the patients that need something more aggressive than laparoscopic fenestration would not be good anyway. A kind of important thing, I think, in terms of determining what to do is not to do the wrong procedure, which happens sometimes. The patients that are treated for something that you can see ahead of time that type of procedure wouldn't work. Well, there are a number of things. For example, one is you have the benefit of being able to wait. So eventually the time in the waiting list counts. So, but you have to wait longer. The other situation is if you have a patient that needs a kidney transplant and at the same time that has a kidney failure, then it's easier to get both organs, kidney and liver, together. That gives you some benefit in the waiting list. So that's one advantage of needing both. Otherwise, is a problem. No. Well, you may be right. Not that I'm aware of. No, time on the list matters.
We'll have time for one more question.
Yep. How do you get a liver transplant from a living donor? You need to have someone that loves you dearly. And then so that's the way. And there are a number of centers in the state that they do living donor transplantations. Not everybody does. But, yeah. Yeah, exactly the same. You look at the tissue, you cannot put them apart. Yeah, exactly. It's a different gene, but it's also autosomal dominant, and the tissues look exactly the same. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Torres.